All right, folks, welcome to episode number 227 of the Lethal Mullet Podcast, here live from Quillen's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia, live also on, of course, the Facebook feed at The Lethal Mullet. That is, of course, the Facebook page, which you can follow this show and, of course, all the video feed that we do on it. And, of course, it's out every Tuesday and Friday in Australia, and some places Wednesdays. Well, it is. I'm your host, Adam O'Brien. And, of course, this show has a guest tonight. That is, of course, Kyle Wagner of FPN. Kyle, how are you?
I am doing good. I'm just out searching for some old gold and trying to figure out how a riverboat ends up in the middle of the Sahara Desert.
Well, especially when this is, you know, a Civil War steamboat.
Yeah, yeah, that makes it even more interesting. But no, I am excited. We are going to talk about a fun movie today, a movie that I think is a little underrated, and I think it's a movie that is also a lot of fun. It has some interesting things to discuss about this film. But you know, it's always fun to be on the mullet, and you know, I don't know though. The mullet's getting a little long there. Are we gonna have to call it like the lethal hair whip soon or something like that?
Who knows? I might even put it in dreadlocks soon. Who knows?
Hey, if you start speaking in a Jamaican accent, we might have to bring an end to the podcast.
Well, I tell you what, a couple of episodes ago, we did have a definite Jamaican theme. Of course, we had Mark for Death with, of course, the great villain Screwface. And it was his twin brother. So, oh, shock, spoiler. Did I just ruin a Steven Seagal film? I did, it is the best of the Steven Seagal films.
I was going to say, that back when Steven Seagal made good movies.
Hey, there you go. Oh, definitely. Well, I tell you what, I class that as a movie. It is pretty damn amazing. Oh, no.
That's really the one that put him on the map, I think.
You know, everyone straight goes to, of course, you know, Under Siege. But, you know, Under Siege was interesting and all that, and it is a big Hollywood picture, a big Warner Brothers picture. But he had to look outside of Warner Brothers to get a decent film done. And, you know, it's got a great cast, Keith David in it, of course, and somebody from the Highlander franchise as well, Elizabeth Grayson.
Yep. So, no. Like I said, that's when Seagal had a good run going, and it ended. And you know, yeah. We don't need to go any further than that because we'll end up talking about Sheriff Seagal or Deputy Seagal or whatever that was.
Lawman. It is a lawman. You know, and he'll mumble his way through all those episodes. It was hilarious. But yeah, we'll get on to something a bit more fun, folks. Well, tonight we've got, of course, Clive Cussler's Sahara, the adaptation that was done by Matthew McConaughey and, let's just say, a great cast. William H. Macy, also in this, is fantastic as Sandecker. look, we've got Al Giannino and we've got the WHO, which we'll talk about that, the WHO in this. All some great stuff. And, of course, Delroy Lindo and many others. But it is a great Indiana Jones-like film. And, of course, based on Clive Cussler's rip-roaring novel of the same name as well, Sahara. And all we can say is this movie gets a three-name review. All right, all right, all right. That worked.
This movie is, I think, is a lot of fun, and it's a lot of fun, I think, because of the cast and especially the amazing chemistry between Matthew McConaughey and Steve Zahn in this film. And I know this film has a very interesting and convoluted history. I think they were really hoping for it to be a franchise, but I think some of the legal issues that revolved around this film really prevented it from getting off the ground properly, and then not doing as well as they hoped in the box office hurt it as well. And it's a real shame because I really feel like this was one of the attempts to fill the Indiana Jones void. And mm-hmm. I think it actually would have been a lot of fun. This is about the time you had this come out. You had National Treasure with Nick Cage not too long after this. Everybody was trying to fill, okay, we don't have Indiana Jones right now. That was at a time when we didn't think Harrison was ever going to come back to the role. And so all these things were coming out. I personally feel like this is one of the best of that. Could it fill that void bunch? And it's a shame that I think it's become a lot more popular in the aftermath on video and things like that. But I think at the time, it just, there was too much turmoil around this movie to give it a fair chance to properly be accepted as a movie that I think is a better movie than most people give it credit for.
You know, it's got callbacks to some great adventure and action films, but it's got its own identity. And it's definitely, you know, the majority of what is in the novel is there. I mean, it's not exact, but it's got the feel. It certainly has the feel. And I think that's what made it such a, it was, I mean, I saw it at the cinemas. So, you know, I enjoyed it. There's a bit of Raiders of the Lost Ark feel to it as well. But just that, you know, between Steve Zahn and, you know, obviously, you know, McConaughey, the two of them are brilliant together. I think, you know, the rest of the cast are fantastic, but that's the heart and soul of the movie. And of course, the books as well is Dirk Pitt and, of course, El Giardino.
Yeah. Well, you know, too, the other thing with this film, too, and I think this is something that I've always found fascinated with this. This is a film that got made when it had a lot of legal stuff going on around it, Adam. And truthfully, I think this is one of the things that turned a lot of the fans of the book off of this, is because the production company never consulted the author.
No.
On the script. The author, of course, being Mr. Cussler, Clive Cussler was just never consulted on this book, and it went over budget. I think it was supposed to have a budget of $80 million, and it ballooned to almost $160 million on the budget. And I know it did not make back the money, but, you know, this was at a time, too, when I think Hollywood was in a state of transition to where people were still trying to make these big budget films, but you also had people realizing, hey, wait a minute, I don't have to have this super budget to make a good movie.
You look at Raiders of the Lost Ark, that was not the most expensive movie ever made, but yeah, it was well-designed, and, you know, all the sequences were storyboarded out. You know, again, planning is what will obviously save a lot of, you know, when it comes down to dollars. And back in, 2010, 2011, when Lincoln Lawyer came out, I was on a thread that Matthew McConaughey was on, and he was talking about that movie at the time. But I got to chat to him for a little bit there about Sahara, and he said, look, it's one of the hardest movies he did. You know, and looking back on it, it is one of the most enjoyable to watch, but a very, very tough shoot.
Yeah, and I just don't see McConaughey as the as a franchise guy either.
I
think he would have if this would have taken off a little bit, but for the most part, I can't think of McConaughey being part of a big franchise, and he's always been a little bit of a different way of thinking to him. And as fun as this was, I think there was a lot of things with this film that just, I would love to see them try to do it again with the author's involvement and see if they could make something out of this, whether it was on streaming or something else. But yeah, I mean, as far as a standalone movie, I think this movie was fun. I think this is one of those, I call, as we have here, we have our Couch Potato Theater show. And this to me is a classic Couch Potato Theater movie, because I can flip it on at any point, come in and feel like I can just pick it up and watch it, whether I'm catching it 5 minutes into the film or 50 minutes into the film.
You know, it's funny you should mention about him trying out for franchises. So obviously this was the first real try, was getting into this. But then Lincoln Lawyer, which is a series of books as well. But then after that, Stephen King's The Dark Tower, where, of course, he came in basically as Randall Flagg, you know, in the Dark Tower books. And so that he would have just kept popping up. He could have been in the Stand movie that Ben Affleck was going to direct instead of that, I don't know what you'd call that miniseries they just did. It was
The Paramount Plus one on Paramount Plus, yeah. That was definitely interesting. And of course, I do believe there is a new Stan movie being worked on in development.
Interesting.
But I think it's how he's been. I think the thing with McConaughey is that I don't think he might be willing to do it, but I think he's the kind of actor that he's not great at going back to the same characters over and over again.
No, that's right. I agree. So, folks, that's what's on the plan for today. Obviously, the 2000 fine Phil Sahara. But before we go too far forward, we are going to have to let you know about a certain great channel. Of course, this bad boy right here. That is, of course, the Fandom Podcast Network, where we celebrate the state or condition of being a fan of someone or something. This is a great creation by two amazing gentlemen, which you can find the site at fpnet.podbean.com. And I've got to say, folks, if you do go there, you'll be able to check out all the great shows on the network. And, of course, one of them being on a Tuesday, you'll get to find this bad boy. That's right, the Lethal Mullet. He looks familiar. What do you reckon, Kyle?
There's something about him. Dark. I feel like I saw this guy in a dark alley some point. Looks like trouble to me. That's all I'm saying. Back alleys, or some guy who wandered in from being on walkabout for a little bit too long, something along those lines.
And I mean, he looks like he's in G.I. Joe or something.
Cobra double agent. That's what I'm feeling there.
And of course, one of the great things is it's got two great co-founders. One of them being yourself, Carl Wagner, yeah. Co-founder.
Yeah, six plus years ago now, I decided, oh hey, I'm gonna let's do this, and I managed to rope somebody else in it, and then roped other people in it, and then I'm like, okay, what have I done, guys? It's all kidding aside, it's been a blast. It's been great, and we try to, as I like to say, we try to make podcasts to feed your ears, and hopefully we're feeding your ears well, whether it's with here on the Lethal Mullet or on any of the amazing shows we do on the network. And we try to do a little bit of everything for everybody. Sometimes it's a little hard on the sanity, but it works and we have a good time.
It's awesome. And I got to say too, like, what a great place to bring everyone together. And one of those guys helping you out was, of course, this fella, Kevin the Radio Nerd Reitzel, FPN co-founder and, of course, host of Blood of Kings of Highlander podcast. I mean, this is one of those guys that is, just always going to help you out, isn't he?
Yeah, but he's also going to hold a katana to your throat and threaten a quickening on you, too, if you don't. He doesn't get his way, so.
And I've got to say, Kevin, where's your mullet, considering that you're a big hair metal guy? You should be wearing a mullet.
Well, not everybody can rock a mullet.
Well, the thing is, I believe if he wore one, Aaron would just about assassinate him on the spot.
There is that, too. We'd like to have his marriage last a little longer than just a year. And by the way, happy anniversary to the first couple of the Fandom Podcast Network. They just celebrated their one-year anniversary.
They certainly did. Happy anniversary to the both of you, who we collectively call Kevron.
Sounds like a gas station.
It does this. Go pump your gas over here. This is Kevron Automotive. But no, honestly, I wish them all the best. And obviously, too, now that Aaron is visiting, that the two of them have some a good time over there. And of course, hopefully they'll be over here in Australia again soon.
Yeah. So, the world is a wacky place. You never know what you're going to get.
That's right. So, folks, where you need to go. You need to go to fpnet.pobbing.com. Of course, the Fandom Podcast Network with all those shows and more. Now, obviously, we covered a couple of great movies over the last couple of weeks, and one of them was, of course, this bad boy, Fortress. Now, we've talked about this a couple of times. Fortress is an interesting one. Out here, it did well. It was 6 months later that you guys got it in the States, about, I think, 1992 or 93. What are your recollections of when this came out and how it went on the VHS shelves?
Well, I remember when it came out in the theater and they had an absolutely bizarre trailer for it. The trailer was just weird and didn't really, I think, explain what the movie was about. It tanked at the box office here, kind of found a second life on VHS and in the rental market. But it was like, oh, it's the guy from Highlander doing something else now. But I think it was one of those movies that's become a little bit of a cult classic because of Christopher Lambert in it. But it's one of those films that, like I said, I think if it would have just been a direct-to-DVD release here in the States, it would have been fine. I think the fact that it hit the theaters and just bombed at the theaters actually hurt it for a good while. And I think it's kind of found its niche now with a certain fan base. But I don't think it was, it's ever never been a film that just hit it big here in the States.
No, definitely. And the other one we covered was, of course, this bad boy, Under Siege. Now, this is one, I mean, it was that good that it made me want to watch his previous four movies. Now, I look back at it now. This is pretty much the golden period. After that, you can't class them as movies.
Yeah, I really think Under Siege might be the apex film for Steven Seagal. He's done a couple ones I enjoyed afterwards, but I think for just pure best film, it's he's in it. But you know, obviously too, I think what helps in this case is you have a phenomenal villain carried by the amazing Tommy Lee Jones, and truthfully, you can never beat Erica Eleniak popping out of a birthday cake.
No, you can't. And, you know, that brings us to today's episode, folks. Looking at, of course, Sahara. You know, I can remember still going down to Reading Cinemas down here at Harbour Town in Queensland and kicking my feet up on the chairs in front of me and just thinking, well, I'm going to snooze through this. This will be nowhere near an Indiana Jones, will it? But I was pleasantly surprised. Great cast. Film kicked along at a brisk pace. It was pretty good. And I love the fact that it's got a little prologue, you know, that sort of Civil War prologue. The film was always stuck with me. I got it on DVD and later on it was one of the first Blu-rays I bought as well. I don't even know if it's out in 4K yet, which we'll find out soon. But what about you, Kyle? What was the first time you saw this movie?
I actually saw this in the theater and I actually went with my dad to see this in the theater. And, you know, we went into it. It got a lot of hype here in the States. Obviously McConaughey being huge at that point.
Yeah.
And I came into it and I didn't know what to expect. And I found it to be, it wasn't the best movie I've seen, but it's fun and it has a charm in it. And I think it has that charm because of McConaughey.
Yeah.
And also the chemistry he has with the cast is that it's one of those movies where it didn't quite fill the Indiana Jones void, but it had the fun factor of an Indiana Jones film. And I think that's what worked for this movie, that and an absolutely phenomenal cast. You know, you have Matthew McConaughey at the height of his powers. Steve Zahn, who I've always been a fan of and thought is very underrated. Penelope Cruz, probably at the height of her popularity. William H. Macy, who I am a big fan of, and thought always a young Rainn Wilson in this film too. And you brought up Delroy Lindo, who's one of my all-time favorite, highly underrated actors. I am a huge fan of Delroy Lindo, and if he's in it, I'm going to check it out.
He's good because he's had a Salute of the Jugger, one of the greatest Australian movies ever made.
Yeah, so I mean, it had all the cast. I think the story, the thing with the story with Sahara is I think they got a little bloated with it, with trying to do a little bit too much going on, but it's just so much fun. And it's one of those movies that you can turn on. It puts a smile on your face. You can easily say, not the greatest film I've ever watched, but it's a goddamn fun film. And you're going to just, if you take it for what it's worth and just enjoy the ride, it's a great afternoon popcorn flick.
It sure is. Now let's let you know out there, the listener today, the Muleteer, exactly what this movie is all about. So this movie is based on the Clive Cussler book. Now, if you're not already reading Clive Cussler, I suggest you do because it is fantastic. All the work that he's done. There's been another adaptation. There was one done years ago and even had Obi-Wan Kenobi in it. And Duncan Idaho in the same movie. That is, of course, Raise the Titanic many years ago. So it's a 2005 action-adventure film, which was directed by Breck Eisner and, of course, based on the novel. And, of course, starring those three in our main cast, of course, Matthew McConaughey, Steve Zahn, and Penelope Cruz, who basically do a treasure hunt, if you like, when they partner up with the WHO and, of course, try to find an American Civil War ironclad warship. Now, how the hell did that get to the Sahara Desert is the big question. And, you know, you've got to ask, because it happens in a number of the Clive Cussler books, is that, you know, it comes down to literally a historic thing of having something that is on the other side of the world coming to the other in a time that it shouldn't be able to. And especially an ironclad, a steamship, getting all the way there. How the hell does that happen?
Yeah, and the explanation they use in the book and in the film, it's like, okay, you can science it up a little bit and figure it out, but it's still a stretch.
That's right. And we should say too, folks, that Clive is someone that is on the water all the time, or was. Sadly, he's passed away now. But of course, he had Numa, which is what we have in the movie. He really has Numa. Like, it's a real thing. And he goes out treasure hunting. Now, probably not quite as much as what Dirk Pitt does, but he's still active, still there. And I don't believe his son's taken over now, Dirk Kussler, believe it or not. So anyway, we'll talk about all that in a sec. Let's give you a little bit more information about this. It was shot in 2003 in Morocco, and as well as in the UK. And of course, as we mentioned, many production issues, and it ballooned pretty badly. All badly.
Oh, yeah. It doubled its budget, and that's not even including the marketing, because this film was heavily marketed. And I think that's one of the things that killed this film, was it was way over budget, and it didn't even come close to making its money back.
No, they did 120 million, or roughly 119, it says here by the facts. But you think about it, it didn't even make its money back by about, what is it?
$40 million,
yeah, which is still, you know, it's a big chunk of change.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, with the marketing, Matthew McConaughey himself was really behind this film. I mean, he had his own Airstream trailer, which he drove all the way to the Daytona 500 across the country, hyping this film. And like I said, it was intended to be a franchise, whether it's filling the Indiana Jones role, or even McConaughey thought of it more of like a James Bond kind of thing. But you can't have your first movie be that over budget and not make money. You're not going to get that franchise stamp. And that's what happened here. And I think it's a shame, because I think if this movie would have been done on the proper budget, they probably would have made a franchise out of it.
Oh, big time. And the thing is, at the end of the day, you have to be firing on all cylinders for a movie like that to just be the ace of the tent pole, the first peg of that big franchise. And it just didn't happen, unfortunately. It's sad, but and the passion that he's got for wanting to do these things is brilliant. It was based on a screenplay by James V. Hart, Thomas Dean Donnelly, and of course Joshua Oppenheimer. Now this is based on, of course, Clive's book. Now you think about it, it's hard enough doing an adaptation of a book, because they're completely different art forms, but you also get to give them credits that actually taking a book like this, and it's a thick book, you've seen the size of it, though. It's like a size of a telephone book. They're not small, but somehow he delivers it, and he delivered it quite well for what it was.
Yeah, and I agree with you, actually, and that's what even makes it more of a shame, because one of the reasons why this film's budget ballooned and why sequels were not made, it was because of the legal issues that were with this. And I mentioned this a little bit earlier. Clive Cussler was not even consulted for this film. And that, in Hollywood anymore, ever since Stephen King really kind of put his foot down in the 80s after several of his books were and short stories were
like The Shining.
I think the big one was The Lawnmower Man, was the one that really kind of finally broke Stephen King. But ever since that happened, yeah, you've got to get your right. If you're basing it off of a book, if the writer is alive, you need to have him involved, even if it's just in a consulting capacity on that. But to completely ignore the writer, like the people who did the script for Sahara did, it caused more problems than not. And they just didn't do their homework. And it's just, like I said, it's a shame, because I really think this would have been a fun franchise. And I really, it's 2005, so we're talking a movie that's almost 20 years old now. And I really think we're at a point now, especially because of everybody looking for content for streaming services. Somebody needs to take another run at this character and these stories, because I really think they could do something special with them, whether it's straight on to streaming or back into the theaters, something like that. But I think somebody could do something really fun with this. And even you could still get McConaughey involved and maybe make him the William H. Macy character going, if you were going to redo it now.
Yeah, you'd have to play something like Sam Decker. Well, let's let you, the audience out there today, know a little bit about this story at least. So we open up in a prologue, which is in 1865, the end of the American Civil War, in Richmond, Virginia. And this is where the CSS Texas, which is a ironclad vessel, captained by a man by the name of Mason Toombs, who's basically got all of the Confederacy's gold coins, everything like that too, all on board, and they're trying to keep it away from the Union forces. Of course, from here, they're heading out into the Atlantic. Now, that's the mystery there for that bit, and then it jumps forward in time to, of course, present-day Africa in Mali, where there's a civil war between a guy by the name of General Kazim and the Tuareg people. So in another part in Nigeria, the WHO have two doctors there, Frank Hopper and Eva Rojas, who are there to investigate a disease there that's affecting the people of Mali. And from here, she is in there basically being attacked by some of these people, and she is rescued by Dirk Pitt. And then they find out a little bit about him. And it's a great little opening sequence, don't you think? Because we get this scene where we get to see he's an action guy, he's a hero. But then we get to see Steve Zahn basically working the cranks and stuff like that as, of course, he gets pulled out of the water. And, you know, we literally seeing him be a mechanic straight up and going, "Pass me the spanner," you know, all that sort of stuff. I mean, it's classic. And then, of course, in comes Dirk out of the water like that too, with, of course, Sandecker out there and, of course, Rainn Wilson's character. I think it's one of the best openings for bringing in a group of people.
I agree with you completely there, because it's got a high energy quality to it. It's got the introduction. You see all the characters in within the shot, and it's one of those great things. Like, okay, this if this was a franchise, this would be a moment you remember in the franchises. These characters coming in, but again, too, with this, it's the energy of this. And one of the things that I'm going to say this now too, one of the great things about this film is the music it uses. And you've got an American band playing the Steve Miller Classic playing in the background. It's just like in the opening credits scene with when the right place, wrong time. And the music helps make this movie so much. And this is one of those scenes where the music really, really does its job.
I think this is a better soundtrack than Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1.
I don't know if I go that far, but it's a damn
I knew you'd say that. All right, so let's have a look at so from here, Dirk, in the midst of this, goes to the town where, of course, they're catching up with their founder, which is, of course, Sandecker, and played by William H. Macy. Really, really great performance. So here's where he catches up with one of his friends there, who gives him a Confederate gold coin. And, of course, there's a clue that the Texas actually did make his way. This is something that Dirk's been working on for a while in the sort of the back of all the action, is he's figured out that what if this might have happened? What if this, you know, had actually happened to the point where it made its all the way to, of course, where they are in Mali? So from here, he gets, you know, says to Sandecker, basically, "Hey, look, can I take one of your boats and go actually check this out and see what happens?" And of course, he takes, of course, Rudy Gunn and El Giardino with him on Sandecker's big yacht, which actually is just really big powerboat, really, isn't it?
Oh yeah, a very cool boat.
Oh yeah. Which we get to see them. Obviously, they have a great scene when after they catch up with the WHO guys. Obviously, Eva Rojas and Frank, they have dinner on the boat and obviously get to know these guys a little bit more too. Eva is classic, you know, hero material, obviously, as Penelope Cruz in this. She's working for the WHO, as she says it real fast in this, but she's so earnest in her performance. It's really good. You could see, I'm pretty sure, didn't Matthew McConaughey and her have a relationship just after this or about the same time? I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that this was one of those on-screen movie real life and movie relationship things going on.
You're definitely a bit of fire there. But of course they get together, and it's great because we get some scenes where, of course, Steve Zahn you know, plays it up as El Judino and Frank when they're cooking. And then, of course, then we get the wit between, of course, Dirk and Al as well, you know. Never the Al, always the Dirk. It always sorts of lines that we see on the boat. As we go up too, we get to see them then also get attacked, which is a great little scene where they're going to have to do a Panama.
Yeah, and I think that was one of the other things too that makes this movie so much fun is the fact that the two of them had served together, they have a history together, and they play up on that history quite a bit. And this is one of those scenes that really does institute that. And again, this comes back to Steve Zahn and Matthew McConaughey having such amazing on-screen chemistry as kind of their own version of Butch and Sundance. And,
oh, it really is. Even with the mustaches.
You know, and I think what plays it up even a little bit better is that, you know, the Al character realizes that, you know, he's not quite in the cool factor that Dirk is, but he's still knows. And that we realize Al is a much more, in his own ways, is just as badass as Dirk.
Oh, if not more so. Al's the guy that can fix anything, but also he can do all the action. He's probably a better shot than his partner is. But, you know, it's a great scene. We get to see them show off their Frogman stuff now, which is a bone of contention for Clive Cussler fans because Dirk Pitt was in the Air Force, if I remember right.
Yeah, I believe that was one of the issues when the lawsuit was going on, is like they didn't use all the facts of the book.
I mean, they made them Navy SEALs. Kind of works. Like, I can kind of see why they did that because they're always
I think them as Navy SEALs, actually, that's an improvement from the book.
I mean, I can even feel the fans of Clive Cussler's right now going, no, boys. No. But anyway, we'll go into it. Obviously, from here, too, they start to unravel that there's something more going on. And of course, the disease that's there is coming from the actual ironclad itself leaking into the water lines, which is getting into from there into the different areas.
It wasn't the ironclad. It was from the plant that they had where they were destroying the toxic waste.
Oh, that's right. It was too. Yeah. But then they discover past that the ironclad. Yeah. But what's great about this too is that we get to see a couple of great villains here. Obviously Kazim, but then we also have Lambert Wilson in this, from of course The Matrix and Timeline, and you know, the Merovingian ends up being the big bad in this, you know, which I thought was hilarious.
Yeah, that's one of the things. This movie cast phenomenally well, and having those actors in those roles really fit them as the bad guys. They just carried it well, and especially in the case of our main bad in this film, he's got the money, he's got the debonair, but he is evil. He doesn't care about people around him, and it works out so well. And again, that if nothing else with this movie, anybody who wants to argue whether it's good or not, it's a phenomenal cast, and it's some of the best casting in a film I've seen from that time frame.
100%. Let's have a chat about that cast, folks. So we've got Matthew McConaughey, there you go, as Dirk Pitt, and he does a bang up job. I quite like him in the role. I mean, I remember Clive Cussler saying that it should have been Hugh Jackman because of the height and the build, and he's not blonde or something like that, you know, in the books. Now, as far as I remember it, he's probably under the money there, but McConaughey inhabits the role quite well. I think he's playing McConaughey, but, you know, doing what he does. But I think he does it quite well.
Well, okay, so this is an interesting time for McConaughey, because before this, he was playing a little bit hit or miss with his movies. I'm just going to go from 2000 forward. He actually did an episode of Sex and the City. He was in the movie The Wedding Planner. He did the movie Frailty. He did Reign of Fire. He did How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. And so he was kind of becoming that romantic comedy kind of lead thing.
Yeah.
And then he does an uncredited role in the movie Paparazzi. Then he does Sahara, which really, since Reign of Fire, was probably his next big action kind of action film. And then it's shortly after this. Yeah, the only
other one, U571.
Yeah, but then he does Two for the Money with Al Pacino. He does he continues doing the romantic comedy thing with Failure to Launch. Then he does We Are Marshall, which is a pretty interesting film in its own right because of the story it tells. Then he does that movie Fool's Gold. He does Tropic Thunder. And then it's probably 2011. I think people really take him a lot more seriously because he does The Lincoln Lawyer.
That's right.
And so after that though, but I mean, I think at this point doing Sahara was a good call for him to try to get that franchise going. And also he just has that action film bring you in personality. He's got that personality. He's the kind of guy the girls want to be with, but the guys want to have a beer with. And so it's not going to be like one of these action films, oh yeah, like over the top and all that stuff. No, there's something about Matthew McConaughey that just appeals to everybody. And it makes him a great choice for this kind of role. And I think it worked out very well. And again, I come back to the fact he has such great chemistry with Steve Zahn. And for that,
the relationship really
between them really makes the movie. And like I said, it works well for this character too, because he's the kind of character people can't stay mad at. And McConaughey is kind of the same way. So I think it was brilliant casting and it worked out really well in this case.
Now we got Steve Zahn as El Giardino. And in my head, I always thought it would be Luis Guzman to play that role. But Steve Zahn really inhabits the feel of what the character is from the books. And there's some great moments that he's got in this. Even when he just leaves him by himself in the middle of that cafe, he goes, I'm going to go and check something. And he goes, all right, L'addition, check, please. All these little moments.
Here's the other thing about Steve Zahn. Steve Zahn is one of those actors. He's great when he can play a comedy role and let loose like that, but he can also play a very good serious role as well. And I've seen him do both, and I think he's very underrated as an actor. I think people will just kind of, I think they see him and they want to see him play more of the comedy because he's good at it, but he's a very good serious actor as well. And I think that the comedy side works for this film, but he knows how to turn on the serious just enough when it's necessary that it works for this character.
I mean, he even took over from Robert Duvall and played the role of, was it Augustus McCrae in Comanche Moon? And he did a bang-up job. Like, there's enough of Duvall in his performance, but it really is just the character, again, really inhabiting what was in the books. And if you're Larry McMurtry fan, like I am, you know, like, he's fantastic.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, too, one of the other things that really makes this movie work so well for me, too, is the fact that, obviously, you have your three big stars in Steve Zahn, Matthew McConaughey, and the lovely and beautiful Penelope Cruz, who I think this is one of her better films for me as well.
It is. Yeah. Bang up. It's great. But you got her.
I was just going to say, I think what really makes this movie, though, is your supporting cast is so well done.
It is. I mean, we've got Lambert Wilson playing Eva Massad. And again, it's just, he brings the goods, folks. But the real one behind the scenes is Lenny James playing the Brigadier General Kazim. But Lenny's great because Lenny can ham it up, but he's also very gritty in what he does as well. He's a very funny guy. And of course, you could see him in Snatch as one of the more humorous bad guys in it. But then the big one is, of course, William H. Macy, pretty much stealing every scene as Admiral James Sandecker.
Yeah, and I think that's the other thing that works, because here you have Sandecker who, he gets it. You just know this character gets it, and he gets what Dirk is about. And yes, he gets frustrated and angry with Dirk some way, but he also gives him the leeway because he knows who Dirk is. And that's what makes him so good. Another guy who's, in my opinion, steals several scenes is Rainn Wilson.
Oh, big time. Yes. Yep.
I mean, this is at a time where he's just starting to people are starting to understand who Rainn Wilson is.
I mean, we know him from The Office. And obviously, and now Star Trek too, playing Harry Mudd.
Yeah,
as well.
But you go back. I mean, you go back to at this time, and he was doing The Office when this came out, but The Office hadn't turned into that huge sensation yet.
Mm.
And you look at what he's done. He did before Sahara. Really, probably maybe his biggest film was Almost Famous.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah, I remember that one. Yeah, you're right. There's a few of those in there too. Kicking along, folks. Obviously, we talked about some of the other casts, but let's get into the production. So, it began in November 2003 and was shot in Morocco, and some parts of Hampshire and Shepperton Studios were used as well in England, but it was also shot in Spain. There was a 46-second action sequence, which actually cost them $2 million to film, but it didn't make it into the final cut. So you can see they're just literally wasting money. McConaughey was paid $8 million on it, and Cruise got $1.6 million. It says also, too, that Rainn Wilson was only paid $45,000.
He wasn't big enough at that time. I mean, obviously your budget is going to, as far as the cast goes, was going to McConaughey and Penelope Cruz.
That makes sense. You know, it's crazy. So obviously there's a costs and bribery allegation which came into the movie. This is interesting. Not stuff that I was aware of. I knew there was stuff behind the scenes, but still. So it was initially greenlit with $80 million budget, rose to $100 million. And then once the shooting had started, it went all the way up to, of course, $160 million. But, of course, the further $61 million was in distribution expenses. And it looks like it's one of the most expensive flops ever made as well.
Yeah. So this was not the time in Hollywood to be going over budget like that.
Mm-hmm.
Either. This was a time when Hollywood was kind of pulling back the reins a little bit on things. So, yeah, that did not help this film at all.
No, not at all. It's crazy. And as you mentioned, there's lots of promotion they did in this one too with McConaughey, of course, taking his Airstream trailer all over the place with his, obviously, on the side, the poster of the movie, and basically going around to many events and premiering the movie to fans, doing autographs and doing interviews at each place. You know, he's kind of done that a few times. And, you know, it was intended to be, you know, basically a run of sequels after this, just like the books. And it's a shame. I think if they redo it, my thing would be they have to do a TV show.
Yeah, I think either that or you do it in a series of streaming films.
Yeah, 100%. It's the only way to do it. And the film, I mean, itself, it is a flop, but you know, its audience are giving it scores all over the place. You know, it's some people really love it. Some people are giving it like no star reviews. You know,
right up to what we want. I think those people are a little bit off in giving it a no star review. I think those people don't understand how to have fun at a movie.
I'd have to agree with you there, mate. But with that too, of course, we've got the box office itself only making 40 short of what its budget was. Still got some awards. You got a Film Music Award for Clint Mansell. Also got Best Cinematography for Seamus McGarvey. And the Teen Choice Awards, McConaughey, Penelope Cruz both won. Both won nominations, I should say, only. But they were nominated for Classic Movie Actor and Action Thriller, Classic Movie Actress and Action Thriller, and, of course, Choice Movie Lip Lock. There you go.
Oh, yep. Yeah. The Teen Choice Awards.
There was plenty of lip locking in that movie. So for almost a decade, Cussler was involved in a lengthy action suit against the producer, Philip Anschutz, and his production company, Crusader Entertainment. It began in 2005 when Cussler sued for $100 million for failing to consult him on the script. And, yeah, as you mentioned, basically it's gone through from there. And, you know, it's sad because at the end of the day, until that sort of stuff is resolved, you know, it's hard for any other adaptations to come forward.
Yeah, and that because nobody wants to touch something that's in the middle of a legal action.
No, I mean, it's just... it's not the right time, and it certainly isn't the right place. But Which begs the question, you know, like, had this taken off, you know, I think, you know, would it have run for three films? Would it have been as big? I think you would have got a couple of movies out of it, tops.
I think you get three, you get a trilogy out of it, and that's probably it.
Yeah. Because at the end of the day, I mean, you know, it comes down to as well, you know, how much interest there is in the character. I mean, we've already had another film. We had Raise the Titanic, which, you know, wasn't exactly the most action-packed thing, you know. And I think, if anything, it was kind of a precursor to the person that did actually go down and film it all, which was James Cameron. I mean, it wasn't the guy that found the Titanic, but we got to see it kind of the way it was predicted, I guess, but, the same. But you look at it, Sahara had the right feel and definitely, you know, I think would have led to some interesting, you know, Indiana Jones / Jack Ryan style movies.
Yeah, I think McConaughey had the personality. I think the character was a good character. I just think, mm-hmm. I think between the over budget and the legal things, it sabotaged it from the get-go. And fortunately, it just precluded a studio from wanting to do a sequel or another studio wanting to pick up the rights. That's why I'm curious if it's still tied up in legal things or if it's just that the surviving family members just don't want to deal with Hollywood anymore after something like that. Because like I said, this is screaming to be remade, redone somehow. And I could see it being a streaming show. I could see it being a streaming run of movies, kind of like what Netflix is doing with stuff like The Old Guard and the Hemsworth extraction film franchise. I think if you went that route, you could do something like that. I just think that it's one of those things where people look at it as damaged property right now, and it's unfair that it's people look at it as damaged property right now.
It's sad, mate. It's sad. So on the Hallenbach scale, I'm going to give this a whopping 4.5 out of 5. I think it's definitely a worthy action fare, and it's definitely one that falls along the lines of a strong start.
Yeah. I think for me, I'm going to give it a 4 because I think it's one of the – it's a highly rewatchable film for one thing. Like I said, it's a classic couch potato theater film. I think it's one of McConaughey's funnest performances, and again, the chemistry between him and Steve Zahn and Penelope Cruz is great. And it makes me sad because I would really love to revisit these characters and kind of give them another shot at something through another one of those stories. Much like, you know, how excited I am about the fact that we are getting a new season of Justified at some point this summer with Timothy Olyphant returning as Raylan Givens. I love the character. I'm always, if I have a good, strong character, I'm at least going to give them a shot in anything that they're going to put this character in, because if it's done right, a strong character can carry a film. But if it's done wrong, it's an absolute disaster. And I think this is one of the cases where I think you have strong characters who carried a film that had some issues. But I think it was just one of these cases too, where I think people just, it was too far from the book. And I think you see that a lot with movies that are based off of a written novel, to where if they get too far off, people just kind of turn on it. And in the case of also the author who had a very strong following himself, it just didn't work out.
No, it didn't. And folks, you know, look, who knows where that's going to lead, you know, if we get another a series or something like that. I think, you know, the books are great. I read the series from time to time. There's a couple of authors I always go back to. I don't read them all the time, but I will, and that's Stephen King, Tom Clancy, and definitely this guy. You know, Clive Cussler delivers what you expect in an adventure, and this movie delivers that feel. However, Timothy Olyphant, you know, the best role he's never done?
What would that be, in your opinion?
A ventriloquist, because he don't move his teeth when he talks.
Oh, he does some. Go back and rewatch Justified.
I will beg to differ on his acting ability, but he does the sheriff role well. I'll give him that.
Well, you know what? I told you had Sundown to be out of my town.
I love it. I love it. Folks, this has been the Lethal Mullet here, of course, for episode number 227 here, of course, of the one, the only Sahara. And of course, you can find all the shows, of course, over here. And of course, that is on the Fandom Podcast Network. And of course, you'll find that at fbnet.podbean.com. And of course, we've had our dear pal Cole here, who's of course the FBN co-founder. And of course, got to say, mate, it's been an absolute pleasure as always chatting about movies and stuff with you.
Yeah. Now, before we get out of here, sir, I can't. The day we're recording this show is the day the Dune 2 trailer dropped. And I know you will be covering it more on your Lethal Mullet spinoff show when you get Mr. Botman back up. But I got to ask you, at least just briefly, what was your opinion of this trailer, first trailer for Dune Part 2?
Well, as predicted, it was going to deal with, of course, the sand riding and, of course, the romance between Paul and, of course, his Chani. And it was. And, of course, we got to see Elvis get into the battle arena, which we will. Of course, that's Feyd Rather Harkonnen. We got a little bit of the May Thy Knife Chip and Shatter, which you know is going to lead into the final fight between them. We got no Christopher Walken as the Emperor. They're holding back that. I think they're going to drop that a little bit closer to time. When you get to see the Emperor talk about space now on, where are we? We on Arrakis now. Thank you, Spacing Guild. You know, we're going to see a bit of that.
Wait, no. I need more cowbell.
Yeah. Where's my spice? I need cowbell before my spice. Spice.
I do have one question to ask you. I've seen the trailer. I enjoyed the trailer. And it's been a good while since I've read the novel. So you got to bear with me here. It seems like they really put a lot of focus on Florence Pugh as the Empress.
Irulan, yes.
Yeah, and I just don't remember her having that big of a play in the original book. It was later on. Am I wrong or am I not remembering right? Am I still a little too melty from getting out of tax season?
Towards the end of the story, she has a big part to play, yes.
Okay, it's been a while, but I noticed that she got a lot of screen time in that trailer.
I think they're doing it because it's her. It's who she is.
Florence,
you know? Florence. But we got to see, of course, Josh Brolin back as, you know, he's been out sitting out in the wilds with the spy smugglers and all that. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting. And wait for, of course, my full review of the trailer soon, folks, on, of course, the Mullet Guild with Scotty Bowman. Over a pizza, I'm sure, over that beautiful stone oven of his.
Well, you know, but the question is how is he riding a worm?
Well, this is true. Well, folks, that comes to the end of our show here tonight, of course, on the Lethal Mullet. And of course, you've watched us here for episode number 227, here looking at, of course, the one, the only Sahara. Well, thank you so much for joining us here and checking out the live show. And of course, thank you so much, Kyle, for being on today.
It's always a pleasure to be on and talking about a movie that I think is one of those just pure fun afternoon films. And it's a couch potato theater film, and it's one of those ones that I will never speak bad of. I thoroughly enjoy it, and everybody's entitled to their own opinion. But for me, Sahara has just always been a fun film.
It is. And folks, we'll catch you next time here. Same channel, of course. Same time.